Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm reporter Dave Speck and joining me is some of the usual gang. We've got reporter John Roberts. Hiya, John.
Hello there.
We've got deputy news editor Mary Louise Clues. Mary Louise, hello.
Hi there.
And we've got reporter Catherine Love. Hi, Catherine.
Hello, hi.
Now, the last week of term is next week for most schools after what's been possibly the most difficult school year ever. But is there more drama to come in the final week? Last night, the DfE put out new guidance on what schools need to know for next week when the requirement for bubbles ends. John, one good thing is that heads and school leaders won't be responsible for identifying COVID contacts anymore because, as I understand it, that responsibility is now being passed to the NHS Test and Trace. So that's a good thing, isn't it? I mean, it's going to cut out a lot of workload for schools, right?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the guidance envisages it is so different to everything that's gone before. So we knew that this was coming, it had been announced, but there's been questions about exactly how it would work. And last night, a big document dropped, which we've kind of broken down on our website.
What time last night, John? It's not like the DfE to put something out at the last minute, is it?
It was 5 o'clock, so...
Okay.
Sort of in the middle range for them, I think. The key thing is, like, up until now, schools have been doing all of this public health work, and now they are basically just been told you might get a call, but you probably won't, and it's all handing over to NHS Test and Trace. And the other big change is, whereas at the moment, if a child has it, you might have their class, the couple of kids in tables who sit around them, or in the entire year group being asked to isolate. What the schools were told last night was that we expect it to be a handful of cases with each case, so a handful of contacts, and you probably won't get a call. That's left some people scratching their heads as to how a child can be sat next to another child all day and not be deemed a close contact. There's a really intriguing bit of the guidance where it says, for example, if they've been on a sleepover, they'd be a close contact. And again, it just has heads scratching. There are some other questions as well, I think, about how this will actually work in practice. So another thing that the guidance looks at is how will children be able to give Test and Trace people at NHS the information that they need? So, I mean, any parent of a primary school child might, struggle to get any information from them of a given day of what they've done. And yet the way the system is envisaged is Test and Trace people will phone the child or their parent guardian, talk them through who their close contacts might be, and then seek to contact them. But will the parents have the contact details for other children's parents? Will the child know the kid's surname? And this sort of stuff. It's hard to see how they'll do it without involving schools, unless there really aren't many school-based contacts at all. And I think it's going to be that. That's going to how it's going to work for this last week. So we'll go from the bizarre thing where we've got, in excess of 750,000 people self-isolating at the moment.
Or pupils, in fact.
Yeah, pupils, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
To the final week, where it seems only in exceptional circumstances will any pupils be identified as a close contact. And I don't know how much of that is just because the Test and Trace service won't want to replicate the work of 20,000 odd schools, or whether it's like a change in public health approach. But yeah, it's going to be markedly different. It'll be interesting to...
Unless they're already isolating. Sorry, I interrupt your flow there. But unless they're already isolating, so the previous rules still apply to the people that are already isolating. Yeah.
One of the there's a couple of unknowns still. The other thing that it did answer was, one thing schools weren't sure about was if Test and Trace phone up and say we need pupil X's contact details, head teachers have said, well, actually that's a breach of GDPR, we can't give that out, but the DfE have said that they can, they just can't share it with other parents, so the parents can't phone the school up and say I need Joe Bloggs's number. On the point about kids who are isolating at the moment, there's nothing to say that that's going to get unpicked, so bubbles are going on Monday if schools want to get rid of them, but there's nothing in the guidance that says you should stop isolating. And I there's just so many people up and down the country in that position now. So I think if you're in the position where your child was in a bubble this week and they're isolating, the chances are that will continue into next week. But there might be some parents who say, I've heard Boris say this is going, so I want my kid educated. And there is a grey area then, because schools aren't the ones making the decision as of Monday who self-isolates. So I do think that's a problematic grey area.
Well, that's another story that you've written as well this week, John, because I think it's the NAHT that said that heads have been hung out to dry on this one, because if they carry on with the bubble rules, as they're quite entitled to, they could prove quite unpopular with parents, couldn't they? I mean, if they're telling parents they have to keep their children off school when that parent may particularly want to send the child to school for work commitments, for example, and that could be one example where there could be a bit of a friction, bit of a conflict.
Yes, and we did that story earlier in the week, and the kind of guidance has kind of given us a bit more information on that. And I think if schools are minded to keep bubbles and want pupils in those bubbles to self-isolate, they're not actually in a position to demand it. That's not the way the guidance reads. This isn't their responsibility anymore. So really, if a child has been asked to self-isolate and their parent is minded that they come in now because bubbles have gone, I'm not exactly sure that on what basis a school could say no, because I think a parent could say, well, I've not had an NHS test and trace tell me I need to isolate, and the government are telling me they're the ones in charge of this now. So yeah, it's definitely, it's really, and the odd thing is, this is like 1 week of potential chaos and then everything changes again because we go into the summer and the government does away with self-isolation. So it's amazing in COVID times how much the rules change and how much of a kind of a topsy-turvy ride it has been for schools. But yeah, you know, at a time when you think we might finally be winding down, there is massive uncertainty. But in actual fact, probably the way the guidance is set out, I think it's probably just going to feel like oddly quiet for schools in this area, in as much as bubbles bursting has been such a big part of the disruption for the past month. And now, essentially, the DfE guidance is kind of like, you don't really need to worry about this anymore. This isn't your thing. This is test and trace's thing. But I could well imagine if I was a teacher and a pupil tests positive for COVID and off they go and everyone else comes in the next day and test and trace haven't been in touch with any of them, you'd be thinking, is this working? Is this right? It's definitely a massive change.
I mean, I might just have had a bad experience, but good luck with test and trace sort of kind of knowing the ins and outs of this, because I mean, my experience is when I've been isolating, like lots of our listeners would have been, test and trace was saying one thing in terms of how long the isolation period should be, depending on if there have been positive cases since you started isolating in the house. You know, when pupils could return to school, one test and trace person was saying one thing, and then another test and trace person was saying entirely the opposite thing in terms of dates and when pupils could return to different parents. So I just, and that was before that they were handling the whole shebang in terms of managing COVID cases in schools. So
I'm just going to ask you, Mary Lou, because didn't the head teacher actually contact you personally as a journalist at TES and ask you what they had to do or something? What was that?
John was sort of being kind to the DfE and saying it was within a kind of moderate range in terms of the guidance coming out at 5 o'clock rather than sort of 6:30, 7 o'clock yesterday. But I mean, in terms of the scale of kind of what schools having to kind of change to a new system on Monday, sort of 5 o'clock on a Thursday is pretty late. And I actually had an email from a local head teacher yesterday just saying colleagues have been in touch with the DfE. They don't know what we're meant to do and how things are going to change on Monday, how test and trace are going to take over. The local council have not said a word in terms of advising schools on what they should do. You know, I'm really desperate. The email was the subject line was help! ! So I'm desperate. Do you know anything? Do you know? And have you heard what's going to happen? And I just think that's absolutely extraordinary.
The test journalists now are having to sort of clarify DfE guidance to head teachers. I mean, I suppose that is our job.
Yeah,
by and large,
that's what we're here for. But the fact that it's late Thursday afternoon, yeah.
Yeah.
The other little bit that's worth mentioning is in the guidance, it mentions that essentially pupils who test positive will need to tell the school So that's how schools find out who's got COVID in their community, via the children and the parents. And it feels to me like that's not a foolproof system either. It seems like it's going to be a very uncertain week, but maybe one with a lot less bubbles bursting, because bubbles don't exist anymore. And it seems like the government's wanting to sort of think that COVID contacts in schools don't exist.
And this thing in the guidance that you said about, that you mentioned, John, about that they will ask, that Test and Trace will sort of ask, looking at specific situations in terms of close contacts, and will sort of, for example, if a child has had a sleepover with a child who's had a positive test, then they would be a close contact, but it wouldn't necessarily be other children that they've spent time with during the day in class. So, but I'm not quite sure what the difference is between a pupil that spent all day hugging their best friend in school, the difference between that and then having a sleepover in terms of contact, it seems bizarre.
I think teachers are going to need a very long break after next week. However, there are some teachers that might not get them, because after getting the teacher assessed grades out the way for the GCSE and A-levels, there could be more work to come on results day on the 12th of August, because apparently there's been a predicted huge number of appeals. And this is one for you, Catherine, isn't it? Some parents are already threatening to get lawyers involved over exam grades, and teachers are going to need to be there to present evidence, aren't they, Catherine? That they're going to have quite a lot of work to do over these appeals. If as Askill says, that there are going to be a large number.
Yes, absolutely. So it does sort of show that that in terms of teacher assessed grades, then the work won't really be done. Even when results day comes along, then there'll still be that huge number of appeals, as Askill said. And there's also, I think, going to be kind of a lot of work, particularly for head teachers. So one thing that came up in the select committee this week was that JCQ has written to head teachers and centres to ask for contact details for the head of centre, and then also alternative contact details to deal with appeals. And they've said, that doesn't mean that obviously one member of staff has to be in every day, but it does show that in terms of what schools need to be doing over the summer, there is going to need to be at least one person on hand all the time to deal with these. So that's, I think, particularly because obviously the exam results days have been pushed back a bit this year as well, and so it's going to be the 10th and the 12th. It doesn't really then create a lot of kind of respite for particularly those senior leaders when they go off on their break, because they'll have that to deal with quite soon.
And we already know that there are a lot of teachers suffering burnout after this year. And Catherine, can I also ask you, why are geography teachers feeling gutted and screwed this week? That was one of your stories once. I think it did really well on our website, that one.
Yeah, so this was really interesting. It was I think it's happening in a few subjects where, and obviously it's really difficult for Ofqual and the DfE to kind of mitigate learning loss for next year, but they are starting to think about it, and they've got this consultation open on what kind of changes can be made.
This is the GCSEs and A-levels, of course.
For 2022, obviously that year group, so year 10, year 12, will have also suffered kind of lots of learning loss over the course of this year, and so they're now thinking about how to mitigate that. But one of the proposals in their consultation is that paper one modules are going to be optional, but that other papers will be left unchanged. But what some geography teachers have pointed out, and this is a huge issue, I think, with introducing optionality into the system, is that if you make some papers optional, some not, schools will obviously have taught in a different order. So for schools that, for example, have already taught those modules that then become optional, they're at a disadvantage compared to schools that have left those modules for next year. And then if they're optional, they can obviously sort of take their choice from the different modules within the paper. So it just means that for some schools, if they have taught these optional areas already, they've then got kind of less time to teach the rest of the syllabus.
But I mean, it's not just geography teachers, is it? It's they're just the ones that have responded, that we've seen the response to the consultation. This is affecting all GCSE subjects, isn't it?
Well, that idea of introducing optionality, it's only affecting a few subjects. So what they did say, they proposed that most subjects would have advance notice of the topics that they're going to be answering on. But for certain subjects, as English literature, history, ancient history, and now geography to a degree, they will have some form of choice over the topics they deliver, and so students will have some optionality in the exam. But it is quite a contentious idea. So when I've spoken to people in the sector about the idea of optionality, I think one of the issues with it is not only in terms of kind of how the order of subjects has been taught, that it can affect schools that way, but also, you know, I've had people say that one of the other issues is that it kind of benefits students who've had less learning loss, in the sense that if they have covered, you know, most of the syllabus and they haven't actually had that much time disrupted, they have more choice in the exam than other students who maybe kind of have to pick something because they just haven't studied the other option. And there's also, I think, concerns that it also, disadvantages students in terms of kind of familiarity with the papers. So I think Jeff Barton said this to me before, that, you know, and I'm a former teacher myself, that we all know, even during a normal year, there are students who answer the wrong bit of the paper or answer on a text that they haven't been taught. And exams are kind of can be quite confusing for students anyway. So if you start introducing lots of choice within the paper that they're not very familiar with, that can create issues too. So it is one way of dealing with the learning loss. But obviously, as we're seeing from the reaction from geography teachers, that it can be quite problematic.
It's still not a level playing field, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah. And Catherine, just while you're on, can I ask you about this this exam rebate story that's just broken this morning? Because we understand that one of the large exam boards is offering a 26% rebate on exam fees this year, which doesn't seem to be anywhere near enough what schools are asking for, what head teachers say that they deserve. Just tell us a bit more about that, can you?
Yeah, of course. So this morning, AQA, it's the first English board that has put a number on what they'll offer schools. So OCR and EdXL, they've said there will be a rebate announced, but they haven't said kind of what it will be. But AQA, they said they saved 45 million during this year, and that they're then going to offer schools 26% of their entry fees
which is the same as last year, isn't it? And the teachers did a lot more this year because they actually did a lot more of the heavy lifting this year, and so I mean it. I know from stories I've written before that head teachers wanted at least 50%, and I think a subsequent story was that heads wanted 75%.
It's definitely much lower than I think what people were expecting. And we've seen some comments online from teachers where they describe it as kind of feeling like a slap in the face, or that they feel it's a bit of a joke.
Has anyone seen the article on TES today by Yvonne Williams? She's a former English teacher, TES columnist, and she says, imagine being asked to cook your own meal in a restaurant. That's what the exam boards are asking.
Sorry, Catherine, I was just going to say, and Jeff Barton from ASCOS said it's completely unacceptable this morning as well. In reaction to that, sort of echoing kind of what quite a few heads have been saying on Twitter as well, like you say, Catherine, slap in the face, etc. They're just saying, you know, schools and teachers have done the lion's share of the work this year. And And the rebate should reflect that.
What does anyone think if some of that rebate actually went into the pockets of teachers, given, you know, throughout May, for example, giving up both the bank holidays and, you know, all the extra pressure and all the kind of extra sort of pressure they've had from parents, for example, and you know, having to be impartial, and all this extra guidance they've had to read and all the work they've had to do. What about if some of this rebate, I mean, it's worth about 100 million just on GCSEs alone. And that's, if you give 50% of the rebate, it'd be worth 100 million. I think 50% of a rebate on A-levels would be 34 million. It's a huge amount of money. And could some of that, could some of that end up in the pockets of teachers somehow as a goodwill gesture?
Well, certainly a lot of teachers, we did a story a couple of weeks ago where, because Ofqual launched a consultation, haven't they, on the process this year. And one of the questions was, describe the TAG process in three words. And there's been probably quite a few that I can't repeat on the podcast.
Go on, just also, tell us one.
No, but there has actually quite a few of the responses on Twitter to that story were pay us back, total slave labour, you know, things like that. There was actually quite, because I expected them all to be along the lines of complete, utter shit show. That those sorts of, which those have been some of the ones that I expect them all to be, but a lot of responses were about the fact that teachers have had to do all this extra work for free. Interesting.
I mean, let's be honest. I think it was the best of a bad situation. What else could the DfE have done, really? It was caught in a storm, wasn't it? No safe port to land in, and this was the kind of the best scenario, best worst case scenario. But I mean, it's just the way that teachers haven't been compensated for it. I mean, that's just my view.
I'd push back on that slightly and say that it's not so much just the idea as the timing. Like, it's February or something. Like, you know, you can't be blindsided by a pandemic when you're like 12 months into it. But and yet, the Department of Education were
indeed.
And they will. Like, I mean, I think you see that happening this year a little bit as well, to be honest, because they're only really going to get, I think, the results from their consultation and what happens in 2022. They've currently said, you know, that's expected in September, and we know heads were pushing for it before the end of this term, so they've now got to kind of wait for the start of the next academic year. So I think it is that. I think it's the fact that, you know, we know from the pandemic now that there might be disruption, and so it kind of needs to be bit more proactive rather than sort of reacting at the last minute and then coming up with a plan B then. And I think that's what teachers have been saying really strongly, that they need to know the plan B kind of from now, so that then, you know, if there is any disruption to exams, they know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, look, I've just had a look at the time and we've been rambling on for 24 minutes now, which is quite long for a TES podcast, actually. How time does fly, eh? but anyway, listen, thanks a lot for listening, and we shall see you all soon. Thanks very much. Bye.
Yes.
Thanks. Bye.